Cool.
His wife ventured once.
No matter.
There's no laughing.
He said.
No. So is the mutton.
It was a jest, but Sansa took it for criticism.
I'm sorry, my lord.
Why? Some cook should be sorry, not you. The peas are your pro- damn it.
That does not sound like Tyrion.
What should be my Tyrion voice? How do I do this?
You wanted to be Tyrion.
Yeah, I did want to be Tyrion, but I haven't developed... I don't know what his voice is going to be. It's been so long since we did this, guys.
Why? No. Never mind.
Why? Some cook should be sorry, not you. The peas are not your province, Sansa.
I'm sorry that my lord husband is displeased.
Any displeasure I'm feeling has not to do with peas. I have Joffrey and my sister to displease me, and my lord father, and 300 bloody Dornishmen.
And with that, friends, Game of Thrones returns to the on-season.
On-season.
We're glad that you're with us. Thank you.
Con saison.
All saison.
It felt good.
It did.
A little bit of reading to start things off.
Really good, actually.
It's been too long. We had a long conversation before we started, who would take who, and eventually resigned to the roles that we did, and I think that the choice of Micah reading Sansa was one of the best decisions we've made in the history of this podcast. Thank you again and welcome.
Does that mean I'm going to be reading Sansa somewhere in the future?
Yes, and every female character in the future. I might switch to narrator, though. I didn't like my Tyrion as much, but we'll get there. You know, it's a little rusty. It's been a little while, but I was mega excited to be getting into these chapters and reading them, getting back into the world of the books after coming off of what a spectacular season 5 we just had. Coming off of that excitement, it feels right too to be getting back to this. This is
why
it feels like coming back home. I don't know, as right as you are to ask a follow up question to my broad general statement that was rhetorical. I have to answer. It seems just as right that we left off where we did when we did. You know, these chapters that we're reading today of Tyrion and Davos contain really just the next steps of the plot. We ended right with the Red Wedding, which is, you know, more or less where season 3 was broken. And it just feels like a lot of this stuff is informing what's left of the book that we're having to read. So Storm of Swords is not nearly finished yet. It's still got at least a third of the book left page-wise, and so many plots, so many things that are basically getting energized in these chapters.
I love how this has all worked out.
It has worked out well, because let me just remind you of where we left off last season. Okay, this is in a slightly different tone than the previous reading I just did. She ran faster than she had ever run before, her head down and her feet churning up the river. She ran from him as Micah must have run. His axe took her in the back of the head.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's where we left off from reading. A very cheery end to our on-season. Arya, who knows what her fate may be. Those of you who have watched the television show know, as do we. But for book readers, obviously a major cliffhanger, not knowing if she were to be later on in this series. And now here we are, as mentioned, with Tyrion. Because what better to follow an ending of a chapter like that than to jump right into a character like Tyrion and, of course, Davos. So, and I mentioned this when we made our post on Facebook and Twitter earlier, that I don't think there are two better characters, two more beloved characters, actually, to start off our rereading of this book than Tyrion and Davos.
It feels like coming home.
It's cool, though, because we had just properly ended season 5 in the last episode of our show, and it definitely felt different today preparing for the time where we meet and record this podcast. It's just different. You know, I feel like there was a glaze, not a negative connotation, but just a glaze before going into the episodes that are recorded specifically alongside the TV show, because it's so so topically current, it's so targeted in the moment. But this is back to what we do for the large part of the year, and it's cool to come back in such an interesting place and flowing in almost a natural stream where the story left off in the television show and how it sort of left off with us, and it's picking up in such a cool spot. So I don't know. I'm very pleased, and I hope that all of you listening are just as pleased as we are to do this. It felt like you said, Eric, sort of like coming home a little bit, reading a few chapters.
A weird homecoming, though. I would say only because when I was reading through these chapters, I was just thinking in the back of my mind how different places these characters are in right now.
Yeah,
right. Especially reading through, knowing that some of them are no longer alive.
Yeah.
But Tyrion, geographically speaking, is, you know, on the other side of the world. And then, of course, you have Davos, who's in Dragonstone, who's opening a letter that is going to take him to where we last left him at the end of season 5.
Reminiscing about Maester Cressen.
Back to a point at the beginning of A Clash of Kings, right? So it's amazing to me that we're kind of going that far back in time. And I'm looking forward definitely to going through the rest of this book and getting all of your reactions to things that maybe didn't make it into the TV show, to see, you know, how characters now go along their story arcs that may differ from what we know.
It's good that you mentioned that, Micah, because as I was reading too, I was picking out a lot of, obviously there are certain moments that do make it into the show, but there's a lot of backstory in both chapters. There's a lot of character motivations that are laid bare and revealed that were not in the show. And it does make the books, as always, a more exciting place, or equally exciting for different reasons than the show, because you do get a lot more depth, a lot more insight into the world. And the Davos chapter in particular, I was thinking that, you know, as you mentioned, the wall, the letter from the wall informs where they are or where they go, you know, where they are currently in the show. And I'm thinking that that's exactly right, that this is sort of the beginning of that arc. So it feels right, even though there's still two books to go after Storm of Swords, it feels like we're at the perfect moment, perfect spot in the books to be picking up after season 5 ended.
So here we are.
I know. Mm-hmm. We're glad that everyone is very excited to be back inside of the books as well. This is good. Mm-hmm. We regret to inform you that there are only going to be 2 more consecutive episodes of this read through of the On
Ever.
Season. We're quite afraid, because in only a week, and we talked about this last week, so please don't act too surprised if you're sitting at home. No. Try not to spit the things that you're drinking. Mm-hmm. We'll be together finally in a week. Mm-hmm. We'll be in Orlando, Florida for GeekyCon.
GeekyCon.
Thanks for that contribution, Eric.
It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a lot of fun, guys.
A couple of notes on our live show in Orlando coming up in just a week. I may or may not have said last week that our show was going to be on Saturday. I did say that.
You did.
I'll own up to it.
Oh.
But it is, in fact, now going to be on Friday, July the 31st.
Good day.
At 2 p.m. on the main stage, so we still have our street cred.
Yeah.
But there is another change to announce
another
about
change.
Our panel. Yeah, we are going to be joined by a very, very cool guest, probably best known to us and to all of our listeners as the inventor of the Dothraki language, Mr. David J. Peterson.
Ooh.
Very exciting. Valyrian, Dothraki.
So, Eric, you're going to have to learn Dothraki in about a week.
Oh, why?
And be
why?
Able to
I'm
speak
just
it
ask
to him.
Half of our live show will be in a different language we're going to learn beforehand. Let that not scare any of you away who are planning on joining us in Orlando at GeekyCon next week. It's going to be a complete blast, and we're super excited to add David J. Peterson to our festivities now on Friday. It's going to be cool. And before Friday, or before the live show on the main stage at 2 p.m., there's going to be an incredible session. We're very, very excited.
It'll be incredible.
To be presenting as part of the Geeky U educational track, Westeros 101, which will be a course, not for technically any of you listening, because you're all Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire
experts.
That's true. But this is for the folks at the convention that are brand new and want to learn some about this fandom and the story and the community. It's going to be a really fun refresher course.
I think we just decided we're going to get up there and tell them to just listen to our 300 episodes and they'll be all set, right?
We're just going
to
play 300 episodes throughout the weekend. You know, just
we get our own station.
We're also going to be playing episodes of Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah.
Well, guys, I think the best way that we can brush up for Westeros 101 is to dive into these chapters that we read for this week. I think, you know, we'll get the creative juices flowing, turn the brain on.
Perfect timing.
Talk some Tyrion first.
Yeah, so many more people are alive now back where we're reading.
It was spectacular to experience Joffrey Baratheon again in his true form, and especially the cheek he threw in Tywin's direction.
I mean, it starts off in a way that you would not expect. It's just kind of, I don't want to say melodramatic, it's just this sad kind of uneventful dinner with Sansa. Where he says something that upsets her, she says something that upsets him, and it kind of just ends with her going off to the Godswood to pray again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's very pious lately.
Yeah,
yeah. Obviously, she has her reasons, as we've read. She's looking to plot her escape. Yeah, absolutely. So I think that Tyrion would be wise to follow along. One time, I know he says that she probably wouldn't want him there, but...
It's really the perfect cover. This is a Sansa that is still, to some extent, very apt at reciting, you know, telling people what they want to hear. He completely believes her, that she's going off and praying, when, in fact, she's, you know, we know she's hoping for rescue, this, that, the other thing. And he puts himself in her shoes, and it's like, you know what? I, too, would probably want some help from the gods if I were in her position. So he totally believes the cover, and it's completely a cover, and she goes off. I mean, he actually offers, because he's a good husband, offers to go with her, and she's, oh, no, 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 you'd be bored.
These two chapters do a great job of bringing back into the fold religion, and I know that we've talked about it so many times on the show throughout the almost 300 episodes that we've done, but just the fact that here you're learning about how Sansa is still, in some ways, still dedicated to her gods and to what she's grown up with. And then we see a bit of that in the next chapter. There's even that one moment with Davos when he is, you know, going through his mind, the Queen's men versus the King's men, and which allegiances they have to which religions. Yeah. So it was just interesting to me that this was still at the forefront of the discussion. And then also something that really jumped out at me that maybe I didn't even realize the first time I was reading through this book was the tension that exists between the Martells and the Tyrells, and that is stressed even in the first paragraph of this chapter as Tyrion is going through all of his problems and the great quote from the Queen of Thorns about Alaria Sand.
is that a great quote?
The serpent's whore.
But you can just see, maybe it's just Diana Rigg in the way that she plays the role, but you can just see her referring to somebody like Alaria with that type of a nickname.
And you can't help but feel a little bit sorry for Tyrion referring to the Queen of Thorns, someone I'm sure he's going to eventually get to know or at least get to learn to respect very, very soon. Referring to her as Mace Tyrell's wizened little mother. It's just interesting being at this, you know, part of the story and feeling the feelings that are here now. After such a long break from diving into the books and the sort of discussion that we do here on this podcast, what a just a slap in the face, the amount of detail and world building that we get inside of each and every chapter. Obviously, we didn't forget, but it's really nice to read it all together and then to come back here and have a pretty hard discussion of that, because we definitely put a different hat on. It's less casual. It's definitely more analytical when it comes to a point for discussion.
Yeah, I mean, they made an entire season out of just what's left of this book. So, I mean, I know certain character lines are extended or pulled early or whatever, but I think that it's clear that so much is about to happen. I mean, like, Tyrion is still where we left him in the show. Obviously, he's over east, but he had that whole bit of being basically disgraced from his family. His father puts him on trial and has him nearly killed. All this stuff has yet to happen. And Tyrion now is still doing what he's bid. He's still master of coin. In this chapter, he opens up the books. As soon as Sansa leaves, he opens the books and starts to try and figure out where some of the money went that Baelish has been spending, and he's trying to follow, trying to make sense. The whole thing with the Dornishmen, he placed them at like the opposite end of the Red Keep from the Tyrells in the hopes that would decrease the tension and the number of incidents that occurs between them. And he's still very loyal to his family. He's still very loyal to the crown. And it's so interesting to see him in this position because of the journey that he's got ahead of him.
It's kind of a throwback to Tyrion as we knew him as Hand of the King.
Yeah.
Right.
Seeing just the way his mind works, the mechanics of it all, and it's definitely something that you notice about him in terms of his ability to lead. And just the fact that you just mentioned how he separates the Martells and the Tyrells, but then also going through the finances, which is now his responsibility. And then he gets a little bit of a knock on the door and he's able to go away. And it's mentioned that I don't think he was ever happier to see Sir Boris Blunt. And off he goes to the Tower of the Hand to meet with Tywin. And we all know what happens in this conversation. It was very well replicated, I think, in the television show.
Tyrion knows immediately that something's up because it's Cersei, Sir Kevin, Grand Maester Pycelle. They're gathered around Lord Tywin, and then Joffrey's in there basically dancing slash bouncing off of the walls. And he walks in and immediately is like, hey, what's going on? Everyone looks really happy, but you're not smiling. I guess that's not too strange. And then Tywin essentially just hands him. It's like when you want to show someone something funny and it's so funny you don't read it to them or explain the picture, you just hand them the phone.
Like the specialness
exactly.
of it.
So he just hands him the roll of parchment.
Rosalind caught a fine, fat trout, the message read. Her brothers gave her a pair of wolf pelts for her wedding.
What fine, fine gifts.
Coming to terms with the deaths of Rob and Catelyn, obviously there are people in this world who are happy to see them go, as evidenced by everybody in this room, save for Tyrion. But this is a huge, not advantage, it's basically a huge event that has happened because it paves the way for, basically it asks the question, what's next? And in this chapter, what I like about this is through the conversation with Tywin, we're finding out exactly what next looks like. There's an entire plan which is laid out that has everything to do with the sort of remaining loyal Stark men, God, if there are any, to basically what the future of Tyrion's own kin will be, or, you know, child will be given the North.
Yeah.
All of this kind of future plan, but none of that would have mattered if it weren't for the success of this mission, which basically Tywin calls, he says the price was cheap by any measure. I mean, he's you're talking about making alliances, which I just remember in the show how we showed him like writing letters, you know, before it happened and sending them off by Raven and having it just work out to where he gets the phrase to do his bidding. And it's basically like he doesn't have blood on his hands. And that's talked about. Tyrion says, oh yeah, the blood's not even on your hands. It's on Walder Frey. How crazy is that? That the Lannisters were able to succeed so greatly.
There's not a lot of mystery here. Like you said, a lot of the plan is laid out very, very clearly by Tywin. And Tyrion's obviously just a little bit bothered that he wasn't told of this grand masterpiece beforehand. And I thought Tywin's explanation, the fact that, first off, Tyrion didn't need to know that it was happening, and he's not going to, A, satiate his curiosity for the sake of it, and he's not going to, B, tell Cersei so she'll feel important. You know, like he's going to
that was really good.
Carry this out properly and carry it out. He did. It was cheap. And like you said, it is very different going from the chapters that we had before. If you guys remember the doom and the heavy sadness and the way it made us feel, those haunting paragraphs heading towards where the Red Wedding took place, where
God,
the crossbow
for 2 months.
Bolts were fired. And now we go here where King Joffrey is elated. The quote is, he's dead. Joffrey sounded so proud and happy, you might have thought he'd skinned Robb Stark himself. It is very different. Balon Greyjoy has fallen to his death. King Robb has now been murdered at the hands of the Freys, and everything seems to be working out quite well for them. Well enough, like I said, for Tywin to be laying out these plans.
He seems to have everything pretty well thought out, but I think he's also a man who knows that things can change very quickly. And I'm sure he had contingency plans in place, but for all intents and purposes, this was the best plan. As was mentioned already, limited casualties, and it gets them the end result that they want. And I also think in this chapter, we got an answer to a question, Eric, I think you asked back during the On season, which was, what was the fate of Edmure Tully?
Yes.
And we know that he is, in fact, a hostage, and that they're going to try and use him to their advantage against the Blackfish, who, even though he goes to the twins in the television show, stays back at River Run in the books.
They want, from my understanding reading this chapter, they want River Run to be yielded so that a Frey can take the place there. And it's so interesting, in addition to Edmure's captivity, was what Tywin tells Tyrion, that Catelyn too was sort of meant to be a hostage. I mean, was meant to be taken and held alive. And we know that that's not how it happened. We know that Catelyn was too bold to be left alive with the events, you know, following Robb's assassination. And just knowing, though, that it kind of is like, words fail, but it's kind of like just seeing her stick it to them one last time of,
right,
oh, hey, you didn't get quite everything you wanted for Tywin. But it worked out well enough that they can all be around celebrating this. But Tywin, as you were saying, Micah, knows that things can change. And just knowing that the plan was altered, or the outcome was altered ever so slightly by Catelyn dying, you know, is a good example of the fact that things change.
Change, things do. And my mind was not shaken, but certainly interested as I read along this chapter and experienced a much different Tywin Lannister than the one that I've gotten to know. This Tywin Lannister was offering Cersei the parenting tips in relation to Joffrey. You know, like he was bothered, yeah, by not only what Joffrey was doing, but he was bothered by the fact that Joffrey was part of his blood. Most of his blood, and was acting this way. He was bothered by it. He was like, hold
all
on.
All of his blood.
Yeah. All of his blood. He's, yeah, like, wait, it's 100%.
I don't care that he's my boss. I just want to know why he's acting this way. Like, his father should have punished him. And then we move on. Let's be honest here. He and Tyrion, they were hanging out pretty well. You know, they had a pretty, yes, they had a decent conversation. I felt like, yes, there was a lot of respect going in both directions.
He says to him, you have a certain cunning, Tyrion. But the plain truth is, you talk too much, that loose tongue of yours will be on your undoing. It's a warning. It's a good warning. It's like, hey, you're pretty smart, but careful who you tell stuff to. You know, like, you still trust too easily. And this is, again, going back to why Tywin, yeah, only trusted the necessary people. But it's tactics are discussed. Family history is discussed. This is, as you said exactly, Zach, they're hanging out pretty well.
It's a Tywin that has remorse for how things were carried out under his command. I know that so much of what Oberyn Martell is asking of Tyrion, which is every time he sees him, essentially, yeah, I'd like to see some justice for my sister,
hey,
and for her children.
Justice. That was a terrible.
To hear an explanation of why it was carried out in the way that it was carried out. This is something that we haven't gotten an answer for. The fact that Tywin knew that he had to essentially show his loyalty so strongly and such a vast amount of, with no uncertainty, to Robert Baratheon after all of the things that have happened, after the chips had fallen during the rebellion in the way that they had, after the Lannisters had essentially been loyal to a certain degree, they had to basically show them that any fealty to the Targaryens was completely gone. And
this
so,
is so cool.
That in addition to what we were just speaking of, the Red Wedding, how, okay, well, I knew that this had to be done, but the Freys did it. It's not necessarily on my hands. It's just, it's such a less, all in all, brutal Tywin Lannister than we got in the television show. It's a much less of a caricature of himself, and it does nothing but paint just a strange look at what's going to eventually happen. I just have a feeling that we're going to see, obviously, a Tywin that becomes much more dangerous and malicious toward a character that we love in Tyrion, as he puts him on trial for something that we know that he did not do. There was going to be a change. He can't be this same level of Tywin in this chapter and then get shot by Tyrion with a crossbow bolt. You know what,
yeah,
I mean?
You know what? You're 100% right there. It's going to be very interesting seeing how that turns around.
Exactly. So it was cool. All in all, I thought it was just a really fun chapter to feel this version of Tywin Lannister, to hear him say so much, to get so much information from him. It's so much more than we've gotten from him so far in the books, even. And I think it has a lot to do with the type of news that we've just gotten. I think it has a lot to do with the mood that he's been put in, and the scale of this victory that has taken place. It's just an interesting time to be in the room with this guy.
Yeah, and he is just one of the best when it comes toward planning and just being this amazing tactician in terms of how he's able to execute. And I think that sitting there listening to him tell the story of what happened to Elia and what happened to her two children was almost very reminiscent of what he was saying earlier in the chapter about Catelyn. Right, that Elia didn't have to die. She it was almost as if he was saying the ones that needed to be killed in this case were the ones who could rightfully lay claim. And it was the same thing with Rob. Rob had to die. Catelyn, not so much.
Right.
You know, Elia's two children had to die. Her, not so much. But knowing that he's now been responsible for two very similar situations, and you know, it's one of those questions where, okay, you weren't directly involved, but you gave the order. You know, you allowed this to happen in two different time periods, but very, very similar set of circumstances. Yeah, it wasn't, you know, it was the Mountain who was doing the killing for you, and Aemery Lorch who was doing the killing for you back in the day. You know, now you had Roose Bolton and Walder Frey and his family, but you're not the best of people here. And I don't know that we're always meant to believe that they are the best of people, but you have to think that in some way this is all going to come back to him, because, you know, I liken it to, like, when you play with fire, you're going to get burned, and I think that's what he's doing here.
Yeah, his hands definitely aren't clean, no matter how much we
exactly
can feel that he's one of the more sympathetic characters. You know, he's just he's appealing to us so much in this chapter, an interesting amount, like I said before, and just knowing that he eventually transforms into something that's serious enough for Tyrion to take such a harsh amount of retribution, it's going to be cool to see.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and thinking about the downfall of the Lannisters that we saw during this season, you know, is it through the actions of the Red Wedding? Tyrion himself mentions so much for guest right is a direct quote from the books. Like, you know, is it a curse? Is it sort of magic beyond magic that dooms? Are the Lannisters doomed? And is it because of these actions that have, you know, this basically this plot that has killed that has killed Catelyn and Rob? Does it doom the whole family to fall apart? Because right now it looks like the opposite. It looks like it's basically ensured the Lannisters stay on top for the duration of the generation or two.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that Tywin, for all of his good parts in the way that he is a tactician and the way that he's been able to carry these things out, like, for example, his plan with Robert has put him into a position that he's eventually become a guy who can sit beside the king and tell the king to go to bed. And tell the king to take some dream wine. You know what I'm saying? Like, so this is falling action from plans that he made ages ago. Mm-hmm. So clearly he's making the right decisions. But where he falters, unfortunately, you know, with the level of action that he takes, you're going to have a similar level of reaction. And so it all kind of caught up with him after the years of mistreating his kid enough to murder him, and the murder of Tywin. Unfortunately, so much of the victory of his family rested on his shoulders that once he was gone, everything spiraled out of control. So those seeds that we eventually see sowed are being planted now.
Mm-hmm. And here is really where you get the first insight into what happened. What, you know, the whole reasoning behind Oberyn saying, "Tell your father I'm here." Mm-hmm. You know, it is. It's sickening to read that you had Sir Aemery Lorch, who, at least if I'm reading this correctly, raped and murdered a young Rhaenys, who couldn't have been more than 10 years old. She was probably younger than that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we know the accusations against the Mountain for what he did to Elia. There isn't much mention of Aegon here in terms of what happened to him, but... you know, it's just it's devastating to read, and the fact that, you know, Tywin, who is also a father at this point, would allow something like this to take place. And he kind of plays it off as saying, well, you know, with Elia, it happened because I did not tell him to spare her.
Yeah. Right.
And it's like, well, is that really going to hold up? Like, is that really fair to say that that's the reasoning behind all of this?
What he does say, too, is that he didn't realize that the mountain was quite as vicious as he was at the time. It was still new. This is way back when. This is not. I mean, now he knows exactly what sort of man Gregor is and sends him to go smoke out the brave companions and kill them all. He knows exactly what sort of man Gregor is. I don't know if I buy that he didn't then, but I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt that this is simpler times, right? And they needed the allegiance of, or they needed to declare their allegiance to Robert. And just like he says to Tyrion, it's sort of a perfect situation where Robert didn't want to kill the kids himself. And so it's basically like the more brutal Tywin Lannister is more brutal and does what it basically does Robert's bidding for him, and therefore is granted the union of being, of basically Cersei marrying him and all that other stuff that takes place, is all because this family was murdered, because the dynasty of the Targaryens was brought to an end by men like Tywin and Lorch and the Mountain, who were bold enough to do it. And perhaps that makes them monsters.
And this is a heavy conversation. This is taking place after Kevin's taken Joffrey away. Pycelle is gone. Cersei's been sent away as well, because they're finished talking about how Robert had a hand in raising their child. You know, this is just imagine the father and son speaking about circumstances this heavy. And it's heavy enough for Tywin to be like, listen, you don't really think I gave that order to the mountain, right?
Yeah.
Or like had any idea that it was happening at the time.
That shows tremendous like sympathy or like heart.
For the man that we've come to know, that's definitely true. But I mean, at the end of the day, there's got to be a line that isn't crossed by people that aren't considered vicious monsters. And he's not crossing it. He's not celebrating it. But then, like we've already discussed, it doesn't change that it sort of happened on his watch. So we learn about Aemery Lorch. We learn about the mountain. And we also learn that Tywin has plans for the mountain yet, and he doesn't want the retribution to be taken out of the mountain. We still have Oberyn Martell and his entourage to deal with, who are in the capital, and Dorne being on their side while all this other stuff in the north is happening is very, very important. Roose Bolton can only fight the Ironborn for so long, so they essentially have to please this guy. And this is where Tywin tells Tyrion of the new plan, which is to blame everything on Aemery Lorch, who we got to know with Arya's storyline.
Yeah, why not? I mean,
he's dead.
Why not?
Easy to blame it on the dead guy. What also struck me, too, is that this is something that I forgot about, how Oberyn was willing to rally Dorne in favor of Viserys, and that Prince Doran, who we of course met in this season, is the easier of the brothers to kind of talk with and to rationalize with. He seems to view Oberyn as being sort of this wild card, and with good reason, who just doesn't seem to be playing with a full deck. But I think, you know, they shouldn't discount Oberyn and just how smart he is. And I think that he's back here for a clear reason, as we know from watching the television show. But the fact that, you know, just the sheer mention of his name too, not only Robert's, but his name leads into this whole story about his sister and about his niece and his nephew. And we got far more detail, honestly, than I ever remember getting about this night or this day. And obviously it's huge significance, and it plays in the altering the course of where we are right now in terms of reading this story.
There's a lot here, and the chapter doesn't go much further than what we've been discussing, but
no,
again, that just the length of our discussion, the depth of it, it just kind of goes to show how much has been put in. It's just, it's interesting because the specter of Tywin Lannister is a completely different beast in the television show. And this chapter alone explains so much. There's so much mystery just gone regarding what's going to happen after the Red Wedding. So much of it is explained. The night with Elia is completely there's humanity, there's feelings involved, there's explanations of why and how things happen, and that also goes for the Red Wedding and the falling action from that. It's really cool to learn so much about this guy and about the decisions that he's been making.
And I think the chapter ends even on a note that you could relate to that with Arya. And look, Tywin knows it's not Arya. Like, he says as much by, comparing it to Renly.
Yeah.
Now everything's supposed to be nice and work out well since Arya is going to go marry Lord Bolton's bastard. And Tyrion brings up the fact that, look, man, Varys looked for her for a fucking year. Half a year. Like, if Varys can't find her, she's dead. And then Tywin is like, so is Renly until Blackwater. So he knows, and he's playing a game.
But isn't this also, can we be on that level, or are we to think that the Hound has done something terrible and, like, gone and turned Arya over to Baelish? Like, could that letter have been sent right after?
I don't know. I mean, I think those events have happened way too quickly, and certainly for anybody to have identified Arya. I think Arya is too valuable still to somebody like the Hound, because the Hound is not going to even look to fuck the king. I mean, he's not going to look to get back into leagues with the Lannisters, and I don't think they want to have anything to do with him.
The end of the last chapter was, though.
It's hugely ambiguous, and it's meant to be that way because you don't know, right, if she's alive. I mean, if you take an axe to the back of the head, chances are, unless you're, Walking Dead, you're not going to be
wearing a helmet.
Yeah, or wear your helmet. and I think you're supposed to be left with that complete sense of obliteration, right? You've lost Robin Catelyn, and then boom, next chapter, the Hound takes an axe to the back of Arya's head. You're like, George, what are you doing, man? Like, you're just completely fucking with people's emotions, and you don't know for probably another 10, 15 chapters, is Arya really alive?
But he's giving us answers now, mm-hmm. We get a chapter like this following that. And the same thing can be said for the next chapter with Davos, really.
Yeah.
Acting so soundly as the Hand of the King, being told by Stannis, you're the Hand, speak up. Like, it wasn't long. Long ago, he was in a very, very dark cell. So I feel like there's definitely a balance, the way the story is flowing, the way the book is being paced. Like, we felt so sad and so somber and then went through what we went through. But now it doesn't make up for it, but we're certainly getting more than what we're used to getting,
Yeah. I do always like how we read these chapters and pairings, because oftentimes there are very clear similarities that you can point out, like how Tyrion was just sitting around a table with what could be considered members of the Small Council. Some were, some weren't. But then here you are, and you really, in Davos's chapter, as it opens up, you're in a very similar kind of situation. You could even call it Stannis's Small Council, even though it's a bit of a batshit crazy contingency with Melisandre and Selyse. But
there's bowing and leg hugging in this chapter.
Even Axel Florent, right?
Yeah, Axel Florent, the rock star, hailing from Dragonstone. If you're an old goo listener. Is here. Like I said, this is Stannis' Small Council. And this chapter is not devoid of brilliant Stannis teeth grinding, mentions of doing your duty, random shouts for a word of light. This chapter has it all. And can I just say, it is great to be in the mind of this man. I've missed him since the last time we saw him in a television show. And it's just wonderful to be back with Davos.
Definitely. I mean, immediately we get jumped into this conundrum, which bears striking resemblance to, I feel, a sacrifice that was made in the TV show recently. I mean, though we're talking about Edric Storm, who I guess was replaced, by Gendry in the show.
Yeah.
We're talking about the sacrifice, meaning death, of this bastard who, it turns out, looks a whole lot like Renly and Robert. You know, and this conundrum of what do I do? This woman is seeing these things in these flames. It's been proven, but then again, it hasn't. She keeps promising me that dragons are going to rise from the stone. And really, what's one boy against all of the people that will die if I don't sacrifice him? And Davos is like, but he's your kin. This is the same conundrum that we've just seen Stannis deal with, except unfortunately, we know the result of that one in the TV show. Yeah. But it's kind of, it really drives home how it's kind of the same Stannis. I mean, as you said, Zach, he mentions duty, and how it may be his duty to do this because of the realm, because he's supposed to protect the entire realm of man.
And we get the same news at the top of the chapter. Our gracious group,
yes,
of Lannisters received last chapter, which is, hello, one of your opponents are dead. And in this case, we can do nothing but congratulate Rollar, the Lord of Light. He and his beautiful Rollar blades skated across Westeros and took out Robb Stark for them.
Is the hand of Rollar spotted and palsied? This sounds, wow, that was terrible. I thought it would be a good Stannis,
it was good.
But it,
it's pretty good.
It sounds
Stannis.
More like
if
Walder
Stannis
Frey's,
was 80.
It's like Andy the now dead Stannis. Is
any
what
gods.
Was.
Yeah, exactly. I should have thrown more.
There you go. There.
Be and quiet, woman. Teeth. You are not at Nightfire now.
It's funny that Stannis is the one in this chapter who is so against the religious aspect of this. He really doesn't believe it at all.
He can't handle it. Salladhar Saan is telling them about what they're calling the Red Wedding.
It is amazing how fast news spreads.
Yeah, when you think about the technology and the geography, all of the both of those things. Both of those E's.
And the fact that news is literally being carried by fowl.
Davos is disgusted that this happened at a wedding. He understands that now the Freys are very cursed.
He gets guessed right. He understands.
He gets it. He's thinking about the leech. And like I said, they're praising the Lord of Light. Axel Florent is all about it, of course. Queen Selyse is just shouting. Melisandre's standing there looking really cool. Just sitting there like, mm-hmm. And Stannis can't handle his wife being happy. He can't. She's just shouting, no man may withstand him. And he silences her rudely. This is just, I don't know, like I said, this is a proper chapter with Stannis, who we've just seen die. And it does nothing but remind me how happy I am and just like really drive home the feeling that I have that it's good to be back into the books.
Mm-hmm. And I know, Eric, you pointed out how what happens, or at least what's talked about in this chapter, is very similar to what happened at the end of season 5 with Shireen. But I mean, even going earlier into the television show, I mean, they do try and replicate a bit of this with Gendry. Mm-hmm. You know, Gendry is really the replacement for Edric Storm. You know, he's brought to Dragonstone. But still, what strikes me about this chapter is how similar it is to the previous one, and that you have a very powerful family who's reacting to the news of really the demise of another powerful family. Mm. And I think the reactions in some ways are similar, but in some ways different. I think Davos and Tyrion really kind of react the same way, which is interesting. Whereas, you know, maybe like Stannis, I don't really know. I can't really get into his head. I feel like he's probably a bit pissed about how it all went down, but all the same, he's happy that another traitor or another false king has fallen. But I would say that this king was probably his best chance at an ally in some capacity, even though I know in this chapter he wants to try and reach out to the Greyjoys.
Yeah, I mean, I think due to the love that Ned and Robert had for each other, and just that Catelyn sided, you know, Rob with Renly, that she was treating with Renly and trying to get in on the Baratheons. Like, I think that you're right. The plan is not yet there on Stannis's end to go to the north to seize one of it. None of that is being talked about yet. But I do feel that, given the love that Ned had for Robert, that the North, well, it's the Starks first, and then, you know, by way of following suit, the rest of the North would probably bend the knee to Stannis, if he could somehow do it.
Stannis here grinding his teeth at the thought of pardoning anyone at all when they've taken up arms sort of against him, or at least claimed themselves a king. The disdain he has for others that don't understand how he is the rightful king is astronomical. Mm. And we see that in this chapter. Yeah. But yeah, I'd like to think that he and Rob would have certainly had less of a head-butting situation when it comes to this. But again, I think he would be very, very pissed off at Rob for calling himself king of the North.
Yeah, I do agree with that 100%. And who knows, he may cut off a part of Rob, or may have had some sort of his justice to dole out either way. But thinking about, again, letting the most recent show events influence, like the things that Stannis, that we love Stannis for saying to John, that he'd legitimize him, that he would, you know, the alliance that he tries to forge eventually may have something to do with, you know, basically the fact that the Starks are a huge, powerful family that has just been dealt this huge blow. They're not on top at the moment anymore, but they could be yet again if men like John sort of take up their claim and start to honor that family. And we just don't know where half the Starks are that are still alive. So it's a bit hard to say what position the Starks are in now, but they have just been dealt this huge blow because their king is dead.
And here at Camp Stannis, action is immediately on the table. We're immediately thinking of what it's going to take next to take advantage of the situation. And of course, yeah. Melisandre says, all right, it's finally time. We've housed him for a while. Shireen has gotten to know him quite well. It is time to sacrifice this beautiful, beautiful child with all that delicious king's blood. And Davos, we're in his mind, has a massive problem with that. Selyse is cheering at the idea. Axel as well is cheering at that idea. And Stannis is just not quite there yet. He feels like this is just a whole bunch of bullshit because not all three kings are dead, first off.
That's perfect when that gets brought up.
Right. Only two out of three. Davos brings that up, which, again, good job, Davos. You're doing your duty as Hand of the King very well. And he just, I don't know, he just feels like it's just too much.
It's just all really juvenile to basically have this group of people sitting around a table that's painted. And
wait, is it finger painted? What's juvenile about it?
Well, no, not the table. I'm talking about the general
great table.
Situation that Zach was just talking about, where you have these adults who are screaming about Roller and, you know, what he is going to be able to provide for Stannis if he sacrifices this bastard of King Robert's that was the result of a fling that he had with one of Selyse's cousins the night of Stannis's wedding in Stannis's own bed.
Ouch.
Knowing that backstory, though, makes it like five times more awesome.
Does that up the power of the sacrifice?
I think it does. So. Only we hear it about five times this chapter. Only death can pay for life. We hear about how innocent the boy himself is. Stannis says it. Melisandre says it. But we get this line from Selyse to Stannis and says, Robert and Delaina defiled our bed and laid a curse upon our union. This boy is the foul fruit of their fornications. Lift his shadow from my womb and I will bear you many true-born sons. I know it.
She'll say anything.
It's just like...
at this point.
Yeah, she will say anything, but I think she believes this, guys. Like, she really...
Yes.
Her and womb is, based on track record, you know, pretty cursed. She's had a number of children that
were not
brought to term. And, you know, it's who's to say that it isn't because of Robert and his drunkenness doing that terrible thing to his brother at the night of his brother's wedding.
Stannis explains that Robert said he was so pissed drunk he thought he was in someone's guest room, okay?
Yeah, really, yeah, yeah. But couldn't he even inadvertently have cursed their union by doing that? Because the wedding is sacred. It all goes back to whose gods you worship. It's all back to religion, too. I mean, whether or not a curse could exist, whether or not there will be a penalty for killing Edric, that this whole Davos's assertion that killing his own kin is not the way to go about this, that would be some sort of curse rather than a blessing, the way that Melisandre is talking about giving a sacrifice to the Red God, and only death can pay for life and stuff. It's like, well, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. Whose religion are you going to follow here? And because they're both sort of opposing.
Why do you have to follow one? Why do you have to follow any, to be honest with you? I mean, That's what to me makes this, and I'm in no way denouncing any religion here. I'm just saying that I think that, you know, there are different sides to every religion, and I think here you see somewhat of the believability factor, right? You need some tangible proof, and I know it's referenced in this chapter. Davos recalls what happened, you know, when they were at, was it Storm's End?
Shadow, baby.
Yeah, so it's just, he knows that there's something that's magical that's taking place here. Does it have to be religion? I'm not entirely sure. Like, I think there's more to Melisandre than just this red god. So I'm left not fully believing in what she's saying, that because, you know, truth is, she says if she went to Blackwater, things would have turned out differently. Mm. Okay, but then why still could you not have helped from wherever you were back on Dragonstone, right? You know, like, come on. You had to have – your ability only works in a certain mile radius. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
it goes into, I think, something that we learned in the TV show, which is that she is in denial, like, currently about the fact that Stannis may not be Azor Ahai, you know, and this is something that was first indicated at Blackwater. I think that was everybody's first indicator. And she is demanding this sacrifice as like a surefire way to bring a victory about. But I think if she were to go through with it, if Edric were to be put to death, and I don't know what's going to happen with him because it wasn't in the show. But you know, I think it may be even clearer to her then that she's on the wrong team or trying for the wrong person. I don't quite know, but I think there's a great deal of denial happening with Melisandre right now.
There is, but leave it to Davos to point out that no man is as cursed as the Kinslayer.
Yeah.
And I think that resonates on some level with Stannis, because I think Stannis believes in cold, hard facts. And even though there is no sort of tangible proof of somebody being cursed, right? It's just all kind of within the natural progression of how things happen after a certain event takes place. But I think, you know, he looks onto others that have done similar things in the past, and there's something about that resonates with him. This is just a really interesting grouping of people to me who think that, you know, that they can trust in this one source that is going to make everything better for them. You know, that Joffrey's going to die. Like, Queen Selyse believes defiantly that Joffrey's next. He's going to snuff it. And then if he does,
then you'll know.
Like, then you will know that Rahler is the one true god, and that you should bow down and take stock in everything that he asks you to do through the flames that Melisandre looks into. So to me, it's all a bit, you know, kind of out there, but...
Well, it is out there, Micah, but there are White Walkers, you know? And just like Davos says or thinks in this chapter... I mean, it's easy for me to think all of this is rubbish, but I saw a shadow pull itself out of her thighs.
Yeah.
You know,
that's like, what it comes down to. That's why it goes back to religion, because these are people who've seen shit. But what did they see? How much do they know about what they see? When Stannis looked in the flames, when Melisandre looks in the flames, what does she see? And Davos himself bets on the reality of Stannis' own visions when he decides what to do with the letter that he gets at the end of the chapter. But it's just like, it goes back to the fact that religion, these insights are number one priority. They are happening in this world and affecting events.
They are. But then there's that one caveat that Stannis just needs dragons and he'll be fine. And everything will work out at the end of the day. And it's like, but that could be true of anybody, not just Stannis. Like, if you got a dragon on your side, chances are you have a pretty good opportunity to win whatever battle you're going to go into.
Can you imagine how sick our live show would be if we had a dragon? Not even three for each of us, but just one of us had a dragon.
Just one.
We had a guy named Aemon with the...
That's true.
So I'm never going to get over that.
That was one of the strangest things that has ever happened.
There is a lot of talk of dragons in this chapter. There's an amazing scene when Davos is walking through Dragonstone, and he notices just how integrated dragons are into literally everything that is built on this island. And I just thought it was really well written.
This is where I'll ask everyone that's listening to this podcast to take a moment and forget the Dragonstone that you've met in the television show, where we have endless amounts of praise normally. I feel like this has been a situation where it has fallen painfully short, and I'm sure they have their reasons. I do like the interior that we see. But that being said, Google or just look up or check out A World of Ice and Fire, Dragonstone properly, and see it for the high fantasy that it truly is, the mind in which George R. R. Martin properly captured it and felt this place, which is a bastion and became such a storied location for the Targaryens of old. And take what Davos sees, the feeling of this great hall being the stomach of a grand dragon, and the way you enter it through his mouth and through his throat,
so cool.
And how the kitchens are coiled dragons themselves, and the list goes on, like how the claws come out and create like the candelabras and the sconces and the places for the torches. Like this is a freaking cool ass place.
It's amazing. Just that one chapter, that one paragraph, just to read it, and you can imagine in all this intricate detail what this island's castle looks like. It's really cool. And to think that any one of these dragons could potentially break out of the stone or even come to life as stone would be pretty cool.
That's exactly what they tell him is going to happen.
Directly from scripture, it says, he raised his eyes to gaze up at the walls. In place of Merlons, 1,000 grotesques and gargoyles looked down on him, each different from all the others. Wyverns, griffins, demons, manticores, minotaurs, basilisks, hellhounds, cockatrices, and 1,000 queer creatures sprouted from the castle's battlements. Let me just say, that is a ridiculous collection.
Yeah,
evil creatures. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
manticores, yeah, and minotaurs and basilisks and hellhounds
and cockatrices and even queer creatures than those.
It's almost like they were frozen in battle.
It was.
Something.
It's exactly like that. Yeah.
I mean, keep Professor McGonagall away from that.
I've always wanted to wake them. The towers were dragons, hunched above the walls, or poised for flight. The windworms seemed to scream defiance while the sea dragon tower gazed serenely out across the waves. Smaller dragons framed the gates. Dragon claws emerged from the walls to grasp at torches. Like we said before, great stone wings enfolded the smith and armory. And tails formed arches, bridges, and exterior stairs. We keep talking about it because it's that cool. So look it up and feast your eyes. And if I were you, I would apply the same grandeur to all of the places that we see. King's Landing, Winterfell, especially everywhere in the East that has such a long history. Allow that to sort of influence the way you see it as we go along in the book together, because that's how it is. Mm-hmm. It's like the Iron Throne, right? The proper Iron Throne.
Yeah, how exactly?
The massive, twisted.
That made it exists, but how is it made? And I think Davos even talks about how the Valyrian, I mean, he's thinking about it, but the Valyrians did not necessarily cut and chisel as common masons did. But it says they worked with stone and fire, with magic as a potter might work clay. So the dragons could somehow, or the stone that's been shaped to dragons could have been, I don't know, if it's sung into that place. You know, what if they were real dragons, he says. What if they were real dragons that were turned to stone?
And that's sort of like the way we see our pyramids, right? The
right, exactly. We still don't know how they were built.
Lots and lots of people that had no emails to check, and they didn't have, you know, TV to watch that night. They just worked. Yeah.
And turn your phone on airplane mode. You can accomplish anything.
George McFly, that's a quote of the century right there.
Love it. But I don't know. It's just, it is this question. They really were pushing, Solis and Melisandre were pushing that Stannis could have almost a flock of dragons if he were to just sacrifice this kid.
But then Stannis retorted with all the Targaryens that preceded him in trying to bring about dragons and miserably failed. So I think that we'll have to wait and see if there's any other dragons laying around that could work in his favor. But the second half of this chapter is something that they, I thought, adapted extremely well in the television series, albeit they did in a very different way. And it really created this great relationship between Davos and Shireen and him learning
well done.
To read.
Very well done.
It was extremely well done. I think there were some of the best moments, some of the moments fans really enjoyed watching. But Davos is really in the same league reading, and in some cases I would say, well, I mean, he even points out he's actually behind the reading level of a lot of the children on Dragonstone, right? It's quite the grouping. We have Davos's son, we have Edric Storm, and we have Shireen, who are
reading
all
together.
Learning to read together. Davos is you know, he's getting there. He's working hard, and he sees a lot of great qualities in his own son, I think, that you know, he wants to aspire to himself.
Except
and,
his son's a zealot.
Well, you know, look, that can – I think Melisandre is enchanting him with her womanly ways.
That heart-shaped face.
But one thing that stood out to me, and again, comparing it to the previous chapter, you have Edric Storm, who very much defends Robert. And I kind of made the connection to how Joffrey really –
defended,
you know, in the
Robert.
Same way,
huh.
Defended Robert,
nice.
To Tywin. And, you know, they're very different circumstances under which they're talking about Robert. But I just thought it was interesting that you had Joffrey, who's supposedly Robert's son, and you have Edric, who's Robert's bastard, who are in two consecutive chapters defending him.
You know, I just wonder if Edric's defense of Robert would serve to help or hurt him. Because if he were to defend, because Stannis didn't like Renly or Robert necessarily. I mean, I know they're the kin, but if you're talking about a kid who looks exactly like Renly and Robert, who were always so handsome, who, I mean, it's basically like, it serves as a reminder that he's kin to Stannis, but if you were to get down to it, Renly betrayed Stannis, you know, and actually insulted him and claimed the throne for his own and was a traitor. And Robert never quite allowed Stannis, never quite gave Stannis what he wanted, the proper respect, the proper duties that he commanded. And so I just don't know if Stannis were in that room when Edric is talking about it, if that would be a good thing or a bad thing. But for Davos, it serves as being, you know, this another example of how this kid is raised right, or, you know, is basically a good kid.
And we sympathize with the polite, well-groomed, well-mannered characters.
Right?
A story riddled with so much decay and dirt.
What did you guys think about the difference in Davos when he starts to read this letter that came from the Wall? He asks Maester Pylos what was done when he first read this, and he said, well, you know, so-and-so was hand at the time, so I went to him, and then we talked to the queen, and, you know, they didn't think to do much with it.
But the official response is, we don't have enough people to manage our own cause, let alone help out with the wildlings attacking the north. So they swept it under the rug.
Yep.
And Davos finds out that this letter didn't just come in. This letter's been here. And so he's going to make things happen now.
He sees it as an opportunity. And it's weird because Pylos, who has spent all of this time teaching him how to read, is going through giving him, you know, books, and Davos is just like, hand it the king. I've got to read letters. I've got to, you know, be able to handle the king's affairs. I don't want no picture book to start off at. You know, he's trying these letters. And Pylos just comes across this one and he's like, this should suit our needs. You know, it's like, hang on, sir. You're playing a sort of game. Like, what exactly is this? Could Pylos possibly know what's going on? And he's giving this to Davos at exactly the right time for Davos to do something about it.
It's possible.
Everyone here sucks. That knew about us. Think about it. Seriously. I mean,
except
I realize that we're in
dragon.
Dragonstone. And a lot of things are happening out of their power, and it's just like, okay, well, let's live the life that we can live now and forget about the circumstances that are far away from us, and they don't have the same sort of transport that we have, so it's not like the threat affects them immediately directly, but this letter clearly states that there has been a king beyond the wall has happened. That first off, the wildlings now have a king, and a massive army is coming. Mm-hmm. To Westeros, and how this isn't a problem for someone is beyond me. It's just, it's, this isn't a letter about, okay, well, there might be some magical creatures that let's be afraid of, these unknown things that are fantasy and that some of us may not believe in. This is a letter that's very clearly saying that people are coming to start a war. So it's outside of the war that's already happening. You would think that, you know, it would not be a letter that's part of a pile. It would, you know, you would think this would be something that they would know about. Would have been kept, not the guy that's learning how to read.
Sealed cage. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just, well, I'm thinking about how it's handled in the show, but you know, the real threat's in the north, and everybody's on board, and everybody's like, oh yeah, we got to do this. Davos apparently is, you know, is going to try and play this as being the next step and kind of maybe distracting from Edric from the plight there. I don't quite know how it's going to happen. Obviously, it's going to happen a little differently. But the fact that this was swept in the direction that it was, and Pylos is revealing it now when Davos is like just able to read it, is it couldn't come soon enough.
You know, if Stannis knew about this, he'd be like, "What? This now? Another thing? Well, something's got to be done about this."
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I like how Davos makes a connection in his mind with everything else that's going on, what Melisandre has said, what Stannis has seen, and he knows that he's going to need to say something and try and get some help for the Night's Watch. I mean, this is really the first. Has King's Landing heard anything about what's happened? I can't remember back into the earlier chapters, but
trying to think, this was way back even in book one, but didn't they send a severed hand to King's Landing?
Again, this is different. Yeah. That's a question of, okay, this is a reanimated corpse, yeah, essentially. But this is a letter from the Night's Watch saying, there's been an attack on Lord Commander. We fear that he is dead, and we know that the king from beyond the wall is coming.
And isn't it in this chapter that they, doesn't Pylos have a conversation with Davos where, like, wildlings are wildlings? Or was it Solidar sound like, wildlings are men, they're just men? You know, sort of giving a lot of weight into the actions of the wildlings. Like, this is a war, this is something that they have to pay attention to.
Yeah, Davos was feeling out his old mission, if you remember. Mm. He dealt with the people that were at the wall at the time, and he dealt with the punishment that fell to the captain of his ship that traded with the wildlings.
Yeah. Again, just another great tool that is used here to have Davos reference the first time he ever went to the wall. Like, unfortunately, like, you just can't get that in a TV series that's jam-packed with so many other important things that need to happen. But I mean, to go on that kind of a journey with this character who we know has probably been all over Westeros and Essos, you know, is really cool.
Well, that's it too, because he spends most of this chapter feeling like he's not useful. And that's part of the reason why he spends so much time trying to learn how to read, is he wants to be useful for his king. But we fall back on this letter from the wall, and he is now instantly able and competent to bring in his experience from when he was there in order to form a plan. He's going to be able to talk about his experiences, which he's already done,
yeah,
in this chapter.
And he's certainly more able than Alistair Florent as Hand of the King. He can literally mid-conversation reference the time he spent on the Cobblecat and go, okay, well, I understand the kind of mind that is inside of the people that sent this letter.
Yes.
So he can know that there's time to take... I don't know. I literally can't put my thoughts around this, because it's almost so ridiculous. I wonder why I was put in the story, because I don't know what sort of people would read a letter like this and not take it serious. Or if they didn't take it serious, right, for it not to be put in a pile that a maester gives to a man who's learning how to read.
It's like an exercise.
It's got to at least go in the king's inbox, right? I mean,
at the very least, it's mentioned to him while he's jogging.
Well, Eric, what's the term you use for Selyse?
Easier than a shithouse rat.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I feel like Pylos is the secret master player. He's Varys's brother, like younger brother.
Well, I don't know if he has the shiny dome of Varys, but it's certainly a very convenient letter to have to be handed and read aloud. But hey, look, sometimes things work out that way. So I think that now it leaves Davos in a position to make a decision. Does he go and speak with Stannis about this? Does he stress the importance of helping the Night's Watch? And does he recognize that now the larger fight lies to the north? And how quickly will they set sail to head up there?
Yeah, this is where things start moving. And it's cool to have begun our dive back into the series at this point in this particular storyline. So high five to reality, really, because it's cool to see the beginnings. I know it was interesting to see how it happened in the television show, and it has not disappointed in the story in the slightest.
I guess that means it's time for us to give our owns.
Ooh. Okay.
First book owns in a while.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
Yeah.
Got to go to Tyrion.
For the
right?
Tyrion chapter.
Tyrion chapter. Mm.
Okay.
I'm going to just jump right out there and give the own to Tywin. It's actually Tyrion's internal monologue, but it's just a comment about Tywin that I think a lot of people believe, just from having experienced his character both in book and TV form. It's when Tywin mentions the blood was in him, referring to Aemery Lorch, and Tyrion responds, "But not in you, father. There is no blood in Tywin Lannister." Was it a soft pillow that slew Robb Stark? Own to Tywin for having no blood.
He's a cold, cold man.
I'm going to give an own. I have a really odd own, but it's...
What a shock.
It's just to... No, it's to Tywin for, in his conversation with Tyrion, which is almost uncharacteristically positive, he has trouble with the word that Tyrion uses, plotting. He doesn't like it to be said that he was plotting, which is, I don't know another way of saying it. So for Tywin, your weird issue with that word, like you think it'll paint you negatively, but you're a man who's caused so much... terrible death.
Who has been plotting.
Who has been damn it, you have been plotting. That's exactly the right word for this. Own to that.
My own will go to Peter Baelish for not letting gold sit about and grow dusty. For, you know, putting gold to good use as he was master of coin, slowly taking down the crown and just a small part in his large plan to take over the world as we know it.
You know what? I have an honorary own, if I could add one in there. The Antler Men for escaping their debts.
Right.
Right?
Well, escaping their debts to fall to their debts.
Right over the wall.
So,
yeah. But hey, they didn't have to.
Courtesy of what were they called again?
Mm-hmm. The Three Whores?
Yeah, the Three Whores.
Davos owns for the Davos chapter. You know, I gave my, I believe it was own of the season. Gosh, was it season 3? One of the season was to Shireen for teaching Davos to read. In this single chapter, Davos has the will and the effort to sort of teach himself to read. And that's kind of, it's like, I'm the hand of the king. I must know how to read. But in particular to just the class time setting with his own son, Devon, and Edric Storm and Shireen. And then there's Davos.
It's like Billy Madison.
It is just like that. So an own to the reading club, the reading group with Pylos as the teacher. It kind of reminds me of that scene in Hook where Hook and Smee, or Hook gives him gives Maggie an F. He's like, I got an F. But she can read it, so it's cool.
I will, just as in the last chapter, give my own to Tywin Lannister.
Hey.
Okay.
And it is for...
A twofer.
A mention on the part of Stannis on his first time at court. And he's telling the story, and he said, "We agreed afterward that the king had been as noble as the dragons were fearsome. Years later, our father told us that Aerys had cut himself on the throne that morning, so his hand had taken his place. It was Tywin Lannister who'd so impressed us."
How emasculating is that, to be cut by your own throne?
Well, I mean, it is the Iron Throne.
I heard
throne.
It happens a lot.
Yeah. That's pretty damn funny that Stannis was like, as a child, oohing and aahing over Tywin Lannister.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. Well, I guess it's my turn. I could give it to Walder Frey for chopping off Rob's head and sewing Greywind's head onto him and then nailing the crown. That's crazy. Or for throwing Catelyn's naked body into a river. Also very crazy.
Why naked? That's terrifying to me. Like, did they do something untoward to her body?
Well, I mean, they at least took the clothes off of it, so there's that. Yeah. I just think that to add insult to all of that injury, these guys have a terrible amount of karma coming to them, and we haven't seen it yet. Not in the books that I know of that anyone's mentioned, but again, you guys kept things like Jon Snow being killed secret for a very long time, so
yeah,
I don't know.
But in the show, we haven't, I mean, we mentioned this, like, there's been one or two mentions that they still exist in the world, but very little insight into what actually is going on.
But my own's not going to go to that. I just thought that that was worth mentioning, that they took some serious action. My own's going to go to Stannis just for his, sharp tongue, and just having, he has no fuse for what's happening, mostly for anything that his wife does. At one point she's shouting about no men may withstand him, crying about the Lord of Light, and he says, "Be quiet, woman, you are not at a night fire now." Like, essentially, it's, you guys aren't out burning people, be quiet. And then at one point Melisandre says that More false kings will soon rise to take up the crowns of those who've died. He says, "More?" And then it says, "Stannis looked as though he would gladly have throttled her." More usurpers? More traitors? Oh. I just think his fuse is so short right now. I just thought it was interesting. I know that's kind of weird, but those are our owns. High five. We did it.
High five. I love that we were able to put a call out just a few hours before recording and get some chapter owns from some of our listeners in, which are every bit as astute and every bit as detailed as the ones that we just gave, if not more so.
I think they're better.
It's time to read our first bag of listener owns for the on season.
Let's hear these thoughts from those who have begun to read along.
Our good friend Brienne of Tarth, who is always
diligent, searching for candles.
Love you, Brienne.
Yes. But when she's not, she's tweeting at us. So, Brienne, keep one eye on the candle, one eye on the mobile device.
Good.
She says, "Tyrion own goes to Tywin for verbally taking Joff over his knee.
Mm-hmm.
Davos own goes to Patchface for being a creepy mamma jamma."
Yeah. I failed to mention that he ran into Patchface on the way to his reading ceremony, and it was haunting.
Something about the old fish eating the young fish
under the sea.
And then the young fish teach the old fish how to read.
I know.
That was Davos, though. I thought Patchface would have looked at him and been like, "Hey, that was a good one."
High five.
Well, let's just say he's had more success than Melisandre in terms of his...
yes.
Right? I mean, didn't he... He got the Red Wedding pretty on point, from what I remember.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Erica.
She says her own goes to Tywin for his parenting advice after Joffrey's tantrum.
Good.
"It appears things needed to be said."
Mm-hmm.
Hashtag world's best dad.
For now.
Yeah. There should be a little caveat there for now.
Rhys Palazzolo. "Tyrion, my own for the Tyrion chapter is going to Joffrey for not just getting owned once, but three times. First, by Tyrion's awesome line, 'Perhaps you should speak more softly to me. Monsters are dangerous beasts,' and just now, 'Kings seem to be dying like flies.' Then shortly after, Tywin hits him with the 'Any man who must say I am the king is not a true king at all,' quote. And then, of course, sends him to bed with no supper."
Mm-hmm.
That was a good one. Three-parter there. Davos, my own group for the Davos chapter, goes to Melisandre for touching Stannis without him cringing away, unlike his beloved wife.
Ouch.
All right, and Rhys is very excited to get back into the books with us. We are equally excited, sir. We heard from Ari Carlson, who says, "My teary own goes to Tywin for having been at least 15 chapters ahead of us, and for his line, 'Any man who must say I am the king is no true king at all.' And Davos own goes to Maester Pylos because, you know, he's a cool guy, and this might be his only ever chance to get an own. Plus, he practically saved the wall, if you think about it."
I guess better late than never, Ari.
There you go, Eric. You got somebody who agrees with you.
There you go. And, you know, just over on Facebook, another listener scrawled upon our wall, Joe Ludwigson, said in response to our call for owns, "Arch, I'm ridiculously elated, joyous, and even chuffed." So, Joe, we're glad that you're chuffed. We're chuffed.
Here's an email If you guys are interested in those sorts of things, it's from Christina K. She says, "Welcome back to the On Season. Glad to have our first glimpse of the Queen of Thorns as Mace Tyrell's wizened little mother." And write back and tell me if it's wizened or wizened, folks, because I don't really use that word very often. "But the own goes to Tywin for dealing with Joffrey, the ingrate, by sending him to bed with an unwanted dose of dream wine after attempting to offer much-needed guidance. Any man who must say I'm the king is no true king at all." That's popular today. "With Davos, we get quite a bit of thought-provoking, recently show-relevant material. You'll hear him screaming when she burns him. Two is not three. We must do our duty. The higher a man climbs, the farther he has to fall." Davos learning to read. Those are all good, by the way, and I was thinking the same things as I read them.
Yeah.
"Davos learning to read, a long-forgotten raven scroll from the Night's Watch, Maester Pylos's agreement that men are men, and Davos remembering Melisandre's prophetic warning, soon comes the cold and the night that never ends." So those were all of her owns. She goes on to say, "But for me, the own goes..." Those are just mentions, I suppose. I can't blame her.
You can do this in email. This is a
example. "But for me, the own goes to Salladhor Saan for reminding us about the horn he could have had from Claw Isle that would summon the Krakens."
Oh,
true. "A horn that can summon any sort of underground or underwater beast, for that matter, is amazing." She goes on to sign it. "More magic horns. Cheers, Christina K."
More magic horns.
Yeah, so thanks to everybody who sent in their owns. Feel free to keep sending them in for Tyrion and Davos, as well as the two chapters that we'll be delving into next week. There are a number of different ways that you can send in your owns. I think we covered all of them. Twitter.com/GameOfOwns. Facebook.com/GameOfOwns. Noticing a pattern here. Mm. And you can always email us, contact@GameOfOwns.com.
Or if you'd like, you can bring them in person to Orlando.
Hell yeah.
Yes. That would be
cool. That would be really cool. Just have an actual scroll.
Parchment only, please.
Yes, real parchment.
No ruled lined paper.
You can get it at Office None Max. They sell parchment. You know, the next two chapters we will be doing prior to our GeekyCon trip are, in fact, John 7 and Bran 4.
Hmm.
That's the next one. So John and Bran. John and Bran. Get a bit of a North theme.
Yeah, and so if you're missing John, ladies and gentlemen, tune in to our episode
or check out all the sightings he's received for season 6.
Yeah,
we hope that you all have appreciated the ruckus that we've been kicking up over at Watchers on the Wall with beautiful pictures of John visiting Belfast and Kit Harington. Let's call people by their real names here. And the rumors continue to circulate. Will he return to season 6? I'm just shrugging. I'm putting my arms in the air. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe he just likes to visit the set.
Maybe he just likes to hang out with Dollar Set, all right? What's the point?
Yep.
nothing bad here.
And, you know, just real quickly, one other way people can get in touch with the show is on iTunes. You know, we haven't gone there a lot in the last couple of episodes, but, you know, we've been busy, so... It's all right, but it is the month of July, so nothing less than 5 stars is acceptable when you leave a rate and review on iTunes. Leaving a review on iTunes is a great way, especially now that we're in the off season for Game of Thrones, which is our on season as we go through the rest of A Storm of Swords. It is a great way for others to find out, not the others, but just other people.
Not them.
We don't want others finding out that we exist.
They will find us.
You know, it is a great resource, the reviews that you leave for people who may be interested in some content now that you know, the TV show is off air, and the more you leave, the more people are able to read through and find out whether or not they want to give us a listen. And especially that 5-star rating is really important. I won't say why, but just trust us. And, you know, we will we'll get to some of these reviews on our next episode. I know we've been promising that, but we will get to them. You know, we look forward to reading them. So head on over there, leave us your thoughts. We always appreciate the feedback. And, you know, thanks for listening.
And to those of you wondering, what are the plans? What has Game of Thrones got in store for this on season? How are we going to approach this reading schedule? Will it be A Storm of Swords from now into oblivion? Come back and return with us next week.
We'll have answers.
We'll have thoughts on the matter. I suppose now is a proper time as any to throw out another thanks for all of you who have continued to hang out with us in this on season. It was a fun time, obviously closing out season five properly.
We do look forward to continuing to read through the books. If this is your first time coming off of our seasonal discussions, getting into the books, hello and welcome. This is something that we do. We don't take a 9-month break like the show does. We continue. We put on our thinking caps and get right down to it, as you've experienced in this. This is the first of many episodes dealing with the book. So plenty of book left.
So join us.
Join us. Between live shows and the amount of story that we have left, not to mention the amount of activity that happens inside of this gap between seasons, there is plenty ice and fire to go around. Thank you.
So just sit back, relax, and tell your father I'm here.